Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we will hear from a civil rights pioneer who visits Siouxland this week. But first, an update on efforts to make the Iowa caucuses more accessible. The Iowa Democratic Party this week announced the first major changes to the Iowa caucuses since they began back in 1972. Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Troy Price says they will now plan to offer 6 virtual caucuses to increase participation. Price says the virtual caucuses will be done by phone or smart device.
They'll have 6 opportunities to sign in on the virtual caucus. They have to register with the state party beforehand, but once they do that, they will be able to have their voices heard in the process.
Critics of the caucuses have said the process excludes people who can't attend because of work or disability. The first virtual caucus will be held January 29th of next year. Price says he doesn't think these changes will prompt New Hampshire to move up its primary date. Price says he's been having, quote, good and fruitful conversations with New Hampshire's Secretary of State. The Democratic National Committee will need to approve the proposal, and there is a 30-day public comment period. There will be 6 virtual caucuses in the week leading up to the traditional event on February 3rd. Democrats would have to register for the virtual caucuses in advance. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. As American negotiators meet with Chinese officials this week to try and end the trade war between the U.S. and China, Iowa soybean farmers are still feeling the pinch. The Iowa Soybean Association reports that soybeans have been hit the hardest by the trade impasse, with prices dipping as low as $2 per bushel. Lindsay Greiner is the president of the association. Greiner says soybean farmers have not had much encouraging news as of late.
Well, soybean prices aren't improving, that's for sure. So I hear the same news you do, that negotiations are going well. But I think that this process has went on for so long that everybody's a little bit skeptical of good news. So I think that's why you're not seeing any reaction to it as far as soybean markets are concerned.
So are soybean farmers still getting help from the government?
That's pretty well over. I think everybody has applied for their market facilitation payment, and I think most of those have been paid out. So that was a one-time deal. There won't be any help coming from now on. So our best hope is that the news is true and these negotiations are going well and they can reach some kind of an agreement here soon, hopefully before the 1st of March when the their self-imposed deadline is.
What do you hear from soybean farmers? I mean, they must be really concerned.
I think soybean farmers are concerned. I have, the farmers I talk to are hoping that a deal can be struck soon. Because they're running out of patience. So they're just waiting for some good news.
That was Lindsay Greiner, the president of the Iowa Soybean Association, talking about the ongoing trade negotiations between the U.S. and China to try and renew normal trade relations. Soybean farmers have also been struggling with oversupply and low prices. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. There's a handful of bills wending their way through the Iowa House and Senate that would amend the bottle deposit law. An Iowa State University economist says that law desperately needs to be updated. Iowa State University professor of economics, Dr. Dermot J. Hayes, says the bottle bill is falling apart and needs to be changed to make it financially relevant today.
It's 40 years old. It worked brilliantly when it was first created by then Governor Ray and Representative Branstad. It was an amazing piece of legislation because there's no bureaucracy. It ran itself and it created employment and kept tens of thousands of tons out of the landfill. Anymore, it's just become a tax. You pay a nickel and you never get it back because it's not worth it. And the handlers, the retailers and the redemption centers, they're only getting a cent in order to handle that material, and it's not enough. And we're running out of redemption centers at a rapid rate. And as you may know, the retailers are very unhappy. So we either need to fix it or get rid of it.
So is part of the problem that people aren't recycling like they used to, or they're not recycling all the things they should be recycling?
The recycling rate is back to 63%. That is people who recycle their bottles. There's some other bottles that come in from curbside, but the actual rate of recycling among those who do bring the bottles back to the stores is only 63%.
So how do we make this bill more relevant and really make it work for the state and the people that want to recycle?
It should have been indexed for inflation. And had it been indexed, it would have been 3 cents handling fee and 17 cents deposit. That's why everybody recycled. 17 cents is a lot of money, and nobody viewed it as a tax. They viewed it as a refund that you're going to get back when you bring the bottle back.
Well, back in the 70s, recycling was new, and I remember as a kid, people bringing large numbers of bottles and cans back to the store and getting some money for them.
And I remember my kids in various clubs scouring the roadside ditches for these things. The other thing that's happened is that we did not have those plastic water bottles back then, those non-carbonated waters, and they've risen to be about 40% of all the bottles sold in the state, and so they're ending up in the ditches and the landfills because people are not recycling them because there's no incentive to do so.
There does seem to be more political will to do something about the bottle deposit law in Iowa. I know it was up last year and it just sort of faded into space because people were not ready to deal with it, but it does seem like people understand that there's an issue with it now.
Yeah, in the past it was the environmentalists versus the retailers. Another, I think the retailers see that if they got a decent handling fee, they could either make a profit on what they're doing or hope that a recycling center would set up near them, and then that would give them permission to not recycle. So I think the retailers have had a change of heart, and they're willing to, instead of just being absolutely against it, they're willing to fix it.
Well, haven't you come up with a number of scenarios how this might work if the law was changed?
I do have a model, a simple Excel model, where I track all the materials because I can get recycling rates by container type. And I also can track the flow of money. And it's a pretty accurate model as far as I can tell. And I told the legislature, if you want me to look at some specific scenario, I can do that.
That was Iowa State University Professor of Economics, Dr. Dermot J. Hayes, talking about some different ways to update and improve Iowa's 5-cent bottle deposit law. Last week, Hayes spoke to House and Senate committees considering updates to that bill. In the House, Representative Andy McKeon of Anamosa has proposed a measure that would expand the 5-cent container deposit to non-carbonated and non-alcoholic beverages, such as bottled water and sports drinks. It would also increase the handling fee paid to redemption centers from 1 cent per container to 2 cents. In the state Senate, Senator Mark Siegebart of Vail, who I spoke to last week, has sponsored a bill which would also double the handling fee. However, Siegebart's bill is different in that it wouldn't require retailers to redeem cans and bottles. Instead, they would be redeemed at state-approved redemption centers. Hayes told lawmakers that because the deposit and handling fee had not kept up with inflation, the redemption process has become distorted.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Last week, the South Dakota State Legislature took on intellectual diversity at the state's public universities. Spurred on by anecdotal evidence of students with conservative views being silenced in class and in extracurricular activities, the House Education Committee voted 9-6 to send the measure to the House floor. The sponsor of the measure, Republican Representative Sue Peterson, said the bill would preserve First Amendment rights on campus. The bill would also require students to pass a civics test and take U.S. history courses before they're allowed to graduate. The executive director of the South Dakota State Board of Regents, Paul Barron, says he wants to promote diversity of thought, but the board disagrees with the need for new classes and tests. Barron said the board weighed in on a similar bill that failed in the State House last year and looked into the issue of intellectual diversity.
So the whole conversation really started at the end of the legislative session last year, when there was a bill that was attempted to be passed and didn't, on intellectual diversity and freedom of speech. But what the nine regents decided was that this really is something that we need to address. And so they actively addressed it. They had open forums and invited both in-state and out-of-state people and organizations to come and testify. They listened to what everyone had to say, and then we began to rewrite our policies. And we had multiple hearings on the rewrites of the policies before they were enacted. And then finally, in our December board meeting of 2018 that we just had a couple of months ago, they were voted on and accepted based on the six months of vetting and 6 months of opportunity to answer questions and to respond to a variety of people's questions. We probably wrote about 1,000 pages of responses to several different inquiries from the legislature. And through that, it helped us to form our vision and our perspective and make sure that we addressed all those issues that the legislature was concerned about in terms of our universities being a forum that is friendly to all different points of view.
There seemed to be some, among students anyway, one student group that would say, there's no problem with this at my school. Another student group would say, well, I've seen instances where people have felt like they couldn't speak their mind in class or at an extracurricular activity.
Well, it is. I mean, it's very difficult to legislate kind of seminal change in an institution. But that's what we are moving towards, and the first thing you do if you're going to try to do that is to address the issues head up, and move into it with good policies, supported by good procedures of how we implement those policies, and then hold people accountable and hold the administration and faculty and staff accountable for the policies that the board establishes.
Now, the bill that is in the state legislature this year, it would designate outdoor university activity areas as public forums and prohibit officials from discriminating against student organizations based on their expression. And then the Board of Regents would set policy that would require state universities to maintain a commitment to free expression. I mean, I imagine that those are things you would like to see happen. Do you think that this needs to be legislated? I know in the State House they feel that way.
Correct. Well, you know, we've started out with the perspective, and I think the Board of Regents has taken the perspective. I know the Board of Regents has taken the perspective that, in fact, it didn't need to be legislated, that we showed good faith last year when the issue of intellectual diversity and freedom of speech was expressed in a bill that wasn't passed, and yet we followed up and made some significant well thought out changes in our policy to reflect what the goals of the bill were. The legislature believes that codifying this into law will help to firm its place in the universities and in policy with the Board of Regents. We are currently in conversation with leadership and with the governor's office. I believe that we will reach a reasonable and rational answer to this and an opportunity for the legislators to feel comfortable, as well as the Board of Regents to feel comfortable with what ends up ultimately creating a broader opportunity for students to express themselves and a broader opportunity for a whole variety of different opinions and perspectives to be supported at the institutions.
You said that the board has worked on this issue and done some things to help promote diversity of thought. What are a couple of those things?
Well, we made sure that we changed our policy definitions of kind of what was allowed. In other words, we stretched based on the recommendations of organizations like FIRE. We stretched our definition of what was acceptable speech, so that even students who would express something that is difficult to hear, that expresses an opinion that is extremely different than the majority opinion, that those folks still have the right to express that and the right to congregate and talk about those kinds of topics. We eliminated free speech zones, for example, so that people can congregate and talk about things anywhere on the university campus, as long as it doesn't disrupt classes and which is our primary mission of education.
It seems like one of the issues in the bill that has created some talk is the issue of requiring students to take U.S. history and government courses and to score at least 85% on a U.S. citizenship test. There, a lot of people don't think that this is fair to especially students who come from other countries.
When the original bill from the House came out, the Board of Regents, and this happened just this week, we opposed it. And the Board of Regents voted to oppose it. However, that opposition led us into some very fruitful conversation, and all of the details of the bill and what all it's going to include is still being worked out. So I don't, you know, whether the bill includes that or not remains to whether the final bill that evolves and emerges includes that, it remains to be seen.
It does seem like you're going down in some ways the same ideological path, trying to create more diversity and freedom of expression. Students don't feel like they can't have an opinion. It does sound like in a lot of ways you and the people who wrote this bill have the same goals.
We do have the same goals, really. The reason that we opposed the original bill was simply some of the language that was created that was contradictory at points in nature, and where the exceptions tended to overpower the rule. And that's what we were concerned about. And you know, if you have a piece of legislation that you're trying to follow and you're trying to follow it in good faith, if you've got contradictory elements in that bill, it's difficult to know what's right, what you should do and what you should not do. And it's hard to win in that particular situation. You know, we want a bill that's clear, that enunciates very clearly, really those policies that we already have on record to protect freedom, to protect students, well, everyone's freedom who comes onto our campus, of their right to free speech and intellectual diversity.
You have so much experience in higher education. You were the chancellor at the University of Arkansas, Fort Smith. You were president of Northwestern Oklahoma State and its three campuses. I have to believe you've seen issues like this come up before.
I have, any variety of them. And there's always a good, you know, what they provide is an opportunity to sometimes I think we get stuck in our ways of thinking about things, and you know, academia changes very slowly. And I think that sometimes these kinds of challenges to how we've done business is a good thing for us. And it's a good thing for the institutions because it creates the opportunity to rethink, to reevaluate, to recalculate for a changing group of students and the different demands of what society expects from us.
So do you see this whole process of talking about intellectual diversity and working with students as productive for the schools?
Well, I would say that I think that this whole conversation and this whole exercise, while at times it was frustrating and at times it you wonder why it's going on, but when it's all said and done, it really has emerged as a positive thing for the system, as a positive thing for the universities. It has really, I think, has highlighted the leadership that our Board of Regents shows has shown in this whole endeavor, and their willingness to tackle difficult issues. And I think those are all positive things because I think it bodes well for a system to have that kind of active leadership and that kind of active interaction that will provide a new way of looking at things.
That was the executive director of the South Dakota State Board of Regents, Paul Behrens, talking about the bill that would enforce intellectual diversity on campuses of state universities. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem says officials are working on changes to that Republican-backed bill. The GOP governor says she met Friday with Republican Representative Sue Peterson, who's sponsoring the measure, to discuss it. The wide-ranging bill would mandate requirements for students, including U.S. history and government courses, and scoring at least 85% on a U.S. citizenship test. Noem says she's worried that the measure could increase costs for students. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. February is Black History Month, and the Sioux City branch of the NAACP is hosting its annual Freedom Fund Dinner this Saturday. A.P. Thoreau is the keynote speaker. Thoreau is the first African-American to attend a formerly segregated state university. He attended Louisiana State University in 1953. AP says he'll talk about the reasons why people hate and how their mindsets are formed.
I mean, we're taught how to hate. We learn it at home. We learn it in school. We learn it from our friends. So then I'm going to move on because we're never going to eliminate the issues of human nature and how people develop as human beings. What we try to do is to teach people, to educate them and blah, blah, blah. So that's going to be my direction to go with this, but also to remind people, and I'm not going to dwell on all of the horrors of what we're experiencing today in the political spectrum, because I think everybody knows that story. I would like to share how people have moved away from this kind of control, degradation, segregation, racial hatred, and how people that I grew up with taught me to develop a life for myself and to help others try to develop a life for themselves where they could at least learn how to negotiate all of the foibles of human nature, political experiences, and consider to develop a better community for everyone. That's the kind of community I grew up in spite of being in a southern city, born in 1936. Left in 1960 and was involved with my family and others from a local, state, and national level in the modern civil rights movement.
You were the first person of color to attend Southern segregated Southern University as an undergrad, but you ended up leaving. And did you leave because of bullying, of being, you know, made to feel not welcome?
I was the first Black undergraduate to have admission, to be admitted to LSU in the undergraduate program in 1953, which was the first white state university in the Deep South to have an integrate, to have a Black person attend the undergraduate school. My father and many of his colleagues, my father was the lead attorney for civil rights in Louisiana for over 40 years. And in many of those years, he was the only Black attorney in the state of Louisiana. He had started suing LSU with the support of Thurgood Marshall and the Legal Defense Fund in 1947, when Black men came back from World War II and wanted to pursue higher education. And we didn't have Black professional schools in our two Black state schools, Southern and Grambling. And many of the Southern states would give you a pittance, give you a small amount of money to go to graduate school outside of the state. I guess maybe that was to ease the pain or keep you from saying the state's not helping me get an education and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, in 1953, I decided that I would go to LSU as an undergraduate. I was admitted on a preliminary injunction. There was continuous work by the lawyers who represented LSU to look for a legal loophole. And after 55 days, they found one and decided and got permission from the court to revoke the preliminary injunction that I was attending under. It was necessary for my father and my lawyers to get the court to admit me until the case was finally decided because I had to be in school. So the preliminary injunction was revoked because they decided that it was a constitutional issue, which required a three-judge court and not a one-judge court. And so the case would have to be retried again, resubmitted, and then we would see what happened. So I left after 55 days and not on my own accord. However, I was very happy to leave because the 55 days that I was there was a miserable experience. I was isolated by the leadership, by the president, by the governor, by the lieutenant governor, by the attorney general, by all of the students, by the professors who refused to touch papers or acknowledge me when I raised my hand. I lived in the dorm. Nobody spoke to me. It was a concerted effort on the part of everyone who was in a position of authority or responsibility there to make sure that I would not be happy and would leave. So I got a pass because I didn't know how I could be successful in such an environment, and I was happy to leave.
So when was the case finally decided?
The case was finally decided and was by the Supreme Court of the United States when cases were appealed to them. And in 1956, a number of cases, including Alabama and some of the other Southern states where Blacks had also decided to sue for admission at the undergraduate level, were bundled and set back down and said, you have to integrate these schools. By then, I was a junior at Xavier University in New Orleans. Had no intention of going back, and graduated in 1957 and then went on to Columbia to graduate school. But it took 10 years for Blacks of any sizable number of Blacks in undergraduate school to stick there and go to classes because of the harassment and because of the degradation and the rabid racial sentiment that was expressed by much of the faculty and many of the students, and the lack of safety and protection that the university was not providing to students who were Black attending at the undergraduate level.
But you say the graduate schools were different.
Graduate students were adults. Many of them did not live on campus. Some did. But they were people who had, they were in their 20s or 30s or 40s. Some were people in their 40s and 50s who had careers but wanted to continue to get a graduate degree to improve their economic status. So graduate students were very different. The undergraduate level was a hard nut to crack, but they stuck. And what the little that I could share with the legal people who were doing these things, I said, don't ever send one student back alone. You need cohorts of students. You need groups of Black students and minority students to go. There were also over 15, some odd thousand foreign students at LSU at that time. None from Black countries, however. You know, so all of the inequities were there. And over a period of 30 years, I moved to New York, got married, had a family, had a career. And in 1980, in the mid-1980s, the number of Black graduates had increased to the degree that they started a Black alumni chapter, which they named for my father, invited me back to speak when they initiated the chapter, eventually got the university to name a building for my dad, and started a lot of activities and started inviting me back to speak and hired people, created an office of diversity, build a Black center for minority students, and eventually asked me to write a book about LSU and my experiences. And I co-authored with a woman who was also an LSU grad, who was a journalism major. In 2011, the book A More Noble Cause was published by LSU Press, which is the history of segregation in the state of Louisiana and the civil rights movement. And that same year, I received an honorary doctorate from LSU. So things have changed over all of that time. And I'm very much involved with LSU now. I was a commencement speaker for the School of Art and Design last spring, and so forth and so on. And it's a very different place now, but there's still a lot of issues. There are almost no integrated fraternities or sororities. The number of Black faculty is not where it should be, although the president and many of the faculty are working on those things. And there's still a disconnect between Black and white students, because that's the country we live in. Last year, when there was a 2 years ago with presidential election, I was on campus and they did a straw poll. Trump received 67% of the votes from the group that was selected to be a part of that straw poll, which was kind of upsetting to me, because here are young people who've had the opportunity to be educated and they were voting for Trump as their selection for president. So we still have a long way to go.
Do you think that kids today, maybe, you know, boys and girls, young men and women of color, maybe also from another country, from Arab countries, from African countries that come here, obviously they have challenges. They're different kinds of challenges, of course, in a way than what yours were, but I'm sure that they feel it just as much.
Well, it's different in different places, you know. I mean, depends on what they look like, how noticeable they are to be of foreign extraction. And it depends upon the culture of that school and how well they are working to bring in people to help with diversity. I've seen significant improvements at LSU. But I can't say, now LSU in Baton Rouge, there are five or six LSU campuses, Shreveport, and other small state universities. New Orleans used to have an LSU. They now call it University of New Orleans, but it's part of the LSU state system. We still have two two Black universities that, you know, were founded for Blacks, but they've expanded and so forth. So it depends, but many of the same issues prevail. And of course, with students from the Middle East now and with the, you know, from Arab countries and things like, they have different issues to deal with. But Black students still are recognizably part of a culture. You know, we're dealing with blackface in the news this week, you know, that has a significant impact on young people. And not teaching our history and exposing Black and white students to these things together, to me, is a big issue. And I'm public educator, retired now, but I've done a lot of work with students, and I believe that we can go forward. Public education, to me, is a big part of how you can really reduce the level of hate and increase understanding and humanity in people.
That was A.P. Thoreau, civil rights pioneer, who will be the keynote speaker this week at the Siouxland NAACP Freedom Fund Dinner at the Sioux City Convention Center. He will also hold a discussion Sunday afternoon at the Sioux City Public Museum beginning at 3 p.m., and Thoreau will meet with Sioux City High School students on Friday afternoon. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Morningside Piano Recital Series will host a special concert on Valentine's Day featuring the 2017 gold medal winner of the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, Yi Kwan Sun Wu. Professor James March, director of the series, joined Mark Munger to preview Sun Wu's program.
Yi Kwan Sun Wu will be performing on Thursday night, Valentine's Day evening, at the Epley Auditorium on the campus of Morningside College. And every artist that comes in is special, but he has a bit of a glow about him because he's a recent winner of one of the great piano competitions.
He's one of the premier pianists on the scene right now. I mean, he's playing all over the world.
And he's leaving the world smitten. He's great reviews.
His reviews have been phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think well-deserved. I mean, he's just one of the most incredible players I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm. And you've known him for a while. So the interesting backstory is when he was at the competition, you and your daughter, Stephanie, were actually in communication with him between performances.
We were. That was really funny. Stephanie and Yi Kwan have been friends for quite some time. They met at a festival in Maine. This was, I don't know, 15 years ago maybe. And anyway, they've been in contact ever since. And the Van Cliburn competition this time was live streamed. And so we were sending text messages back and forth with Yi Kwan between rounds of the competition. And he was writing us from backstage and we were talking back and forth. And it was really fun.
In his bio, he talks about liking cooking and that being very important. He seems very just personable and well-grounded.
Extraordinarily personable, well-grounded, well-balanced. He's as nice as anybody you'd ever want to meet.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a good chance to meet him coming to Sioux City, and he will be performing one of the pieces that he did perform during the competition.
Right.
The Percy Grainger.
Actually, a couple of the pieces on the recital are from the competition repertoire.
Okay. So we get to relive that wonderful experience.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the Grainger. He's going to do the love duet from Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, and it's been arranged by Percy Grainger. And Grainger was an Australian pianist and composer who wrote quite a number of arrangements, piano paraphrases like this, and some of them are in the grand romantic tradition of Liszt and Rachmaninoff with the piano paraphrases. I think the piece is actually titled Ramble on the Last Love Duet, and I like that title. It's kind of comes from him meandering or rambling through the works of other composers that he really liked and then elaborating in a fantasy-like way on his favorite tunes from those pieces. And this one is based on the love duet between Sophie and Octavian from the final scene of Der Rosenkavalier. A little bit of an unusual style. It can sound a little bit dated, but it's extraordinarily elegant, luxurious, almost frilly at times, but it really gives you a picture of the style of the virtuosic salon music that was so popular in the early 1900s.
Followed by a piece by Schubert, the Piano Sonata number 19 in C minor.
Yeah, this is a very late work by Schubert. It was written in 1828, less than a year after Beethoven died and only about 3 months before Schubert died. It's a large four-movement work, clearly exhibits the influence of Beethoven on Schubert's writing. Schubert chose the key of C minor for this work, and that's a little bit interesting because that's the same key Beethoven chose for some of his more turbulent, serious works, you know, like the Fifth Symphony and the Pathetique Sonata. And throughout this whole piece, Schubert seems to be hinting at how familiar he was with Beethoven's compositional style. The opening theme of the first movement is modeled after the theme from Beethoven's 32 Variations.
Hearing the references to Beethoven and knowing his admiration for Beethoven.
The two composers are compared a lot of times. Uh-huh. Beethoven being thought of as a classicist looking forward into the Romantic age, and Schubert as a romantic kind of looking back fondly at classical styles and forms. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an interesting crossover between the two.
Yeah, especially since they were contemporaries and to have
they
that,
were.
That.
We don't think of that a lot of times, but they just died, you know, about a year apart.
Second half of the program is Chopin. Preludes, Opus 28, and that will take us in many directions.
It's a really interesting set. It was written in 1839. Chopin was only 19 years old when he wrote this set, and actually many of the preludes were written a couple of years before that. He was probably inspired to write the works because of J.S. Bach's collection of 24 Preludes and Fugues in the Well-Tempered Clavier. Bach wrote two sets of those, Preludes and Fugues in all major and minor keys. And Chopin kind of imitated that, writing in all the major and minor keys with this set. Most of Chopin's preludes are very short, some of them only a few measures in length, but they really explore a wide range of emotions. Some of them are very simple and charming, and others are, you know, very emotional and virtuosically brilliant, dramatic, and as demanding as anything that Chopin ever wrote. And it sometimes feels almost that the brevity of these pieces intensifies the effect, you know, kind of like a reduction sauce in cooking, you know, sort of concentrates the flavor. And I think there's a little bit of that goes on with these. There's absolutely no musical filler in this set anywhere. It's just, every piece is just a true gem.
Will be very exciting recital happening on Valentine's Day evening. A good thing to take your special person out to.
Absolutely.
That night, right? Following dinner, it begins at 7:30. It's free. It's open to the public, and I can't imagine a better thing to do that night than go to this. So, yes. Well, thank you so much, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. James March, speaking with Siouxland Public Media's Mark Munger about tomorrow's recital at Epley Auditorium featuring Ye Kwan Sun Wu. The recital begins at 7:30 p.m. It's free and it's open to the public. And a final news note today. After two unanimous votes and some signatures on a sharing agreement yesterday, Woodbury County in July will officially be in a new regional group connecting low-income and disabled individuals with mental health services. The work by county officials to pull out of Sioux River's Regional Mental Health and Disability Services Agency and become a member of the Rolling Hills Community Services Region spread out over 2 years. That step was approved by county leaders of Buena Vista, Calhoun, Carroll, Cherokee, Crawford, Ida, and Sac counties in Rolling Hills last year. Since then, Woodbury County has worked to continue services in Sioux Rivers and set up a new budget. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Be sure to join us next week for a new program. I'm Murray Hartnett.